Chapter 9. Giordino whipped along a bare 10 meters, 33 feet above the tops of the trees, at only 144 kilometers, 90 miles an hour. The 20-year-old helicopter was capable of flying almost another 100 kilometers faster, but he reduced speed to conserve what little fuel he had left after passing over the mountains. Only one more range of foothills and a narrow coastal plain separated the aircraft from the sea. Every third minute he glanced warily at the fuel gauges. The needles were edging uncomfortably close to the red. His eyes returned to the green foliage rushing past below. The forest was thick, and the clearings were scattered with large boulders. It was a decidedly unfriendly place to force-land a helicopter. Pitt had limped back into the cargo compartment and begun passing out the life vests. Shannon followed, firmly took the vests out of his hands, and handed them to Rogers. "No, you don't," she said firmly, pushing Pitt into a canvas seat mounted along the bulkhead of the fuselage. She nodded at the loosely knotted, blood-soaked bandana around his leg. "You sit down and stay put." She found a first-aid kit in a metal locker and knelt in front of him. Without the slightest sign of nervous stress, she cut off Pitt's pant leg, cleaned the wound, and competently sewed the 8 stitches to close the wound before wrapping a bandage around it. "Nice job," said Pitt admiringly. "You missed your calling as an angel of mercy." "You were lucky." She snapped the lid on the first-aid kit. The bullet merely sliced the skin. "Why do I feel as though you've acted on General Hospital?" Shannon smiled. "I was raised on a farm with 5 brothers who were always discovering new ways to injure themselves." "What turned you to archaeology?" "There was an old Indian burial mound in one corner of our wheat field. I used to dig around it for arrowheads. For a book report in high school, I found a text on the excavation of the Hopewell Indian culture burial mounds in southern Ohio. Inspired, I began digging into the site on our farm. After finding several pieces of pottery and 4 skeletons, I was hooked. Hardly a professional dig, mind you. I learned how to excavate properly in college and became fascinated with cultural development in the Central Andes, and made up my mind to specialize in that area." Pitt looked at her silently for a moment. "When did you first meet Doc Miller?" "Only briefly, about 6 years ago, when I was working on my doctorate. I attended a lecture he gave on the Inca Highway Network that ran from the Colombian-Ecuador border almost 5,000 kilometers to central Chile. It was his work that inspired me to focus my studies on Andean culture. I've been coming down here ever since."
"Then you didn't really know him very well?" Pitt questioned.
Shannon shook her head. "Like most archaeologists, we concentrated on our own pet projects. We corresponded occasionally and exchanged data. About 6 months ago, I invited him to come along on this expedition to supervise the Peruvian University student volunteers. He was between projects and accepted. Then he kindly offered to fly down from the States 5 weeks early to begin preparations, arranging permits from the Peruvians, setting up the logistics for equipment and supplies, that sort of thing. Juan Chaco and he worked closely together."
"When you arrived, did you notice anything different about him?"
A curious look appeared in Shannon's eyes. "What an odd question."
"His looks, his actions," Pitt persisted.
She thought a moment. "Since Phoenix, he had grown a beard and lost about 15 pounds, but now that I think of it, he rarely removed his sunglasses."
"Any change in his voice?"
She shrugged. "A little deeper, perhaps. I thought he had a cold."
"Did you notice whether he wore a ring, one with a large amber setting?"
Her eyes narrowed. "A 60-million-year-old piece of yellow amber with the fossil of a primitive ant in the center? Doc was proud of that ring.
I remember him wearing it during the Inca Road survey, but it wasn't on his hand at the sacred well. When I asked him why it was missing, he said the ring became loose on his finger after his weight loss, and he left it home to be resized. How do you know about Doc's ring? Pitt had been wearing the amber ring he had taken from the corpse at the bottom of the sacred well with the setting unseen under his finger. He slipped it off and handed it to Shannon without speaking. She held it up to the light from a round window, staring in amazement at the tiny ancient insect embedded in the amber.
Where?
Her voice trailed off. Whoever posed as Doc murdered him and took his place. You accepted the imposter because there was no reason not to. The possibility of foul play never entered your mind. The killer's only mistake was forgetting to remove the ring when he threw Doc's body into the sinkhole.
You're saying Doc was murdered before I left the States? She stated in bewilderment.
Only a day or two after he arrived at the campsite, Pitt explained. Judging from the condition of the body, he must have been underwater for more than a month.
Strange that Miles and I missed seeing him.
Not so strange. You descended directly in front of the passage to the adjoining cavern and were sucked in almost immediately. I reached the bottom on the opposite side and was able to swim a search grid, looking for what I thought would be two fresh bodies before the surge caught me. Instead, I found Doc's remains and the bones of a 16th-century Spanish soldier.
So Doc really was murdered, she said as a look of horror dawned on her face. Juan Chaco must have known because he was the liaison for our project and was working with Doc before we arrived. Is it possible he was involved?
Pitt nodded. Up to his eyeballs. If you were smuggling ancient treasures, where could you find a better informant and front man than an internationally respected archaeological expert and government official?
Then who was the imposter?
Another agent of the Solpe Machaco. A canny operator who staged a masterful performance of his death with Amaru's help. Perhaps he's one of the men at the top of the organization who doesn't mind getting his hands dirty. We may never know.
If he murdered Doc, he deserves to be hanged, Shannon said, her hazel eyes glinting with anger.
At least we'll be able to nail Juan Chaco to the door of a Peruvian courthouse. Pitt suddenly tensed and swung toward the cockpit as Giordino threw the helicopter in a steeply banked circle. What's up?
A gut feeling, Giordino answered. I decided to run a 360 to check our tail. Good thing I'm sensitive to vibes. We've got company.
Pitt pushed himself to his feet, returned to the cockpit, and, favoring his leg, eased into the co-pilot seat.
Bandits or good guys, he asked.
Our pals who dropped in on us at the temple didn't fall for your artful dodge to Chiclayo. Without taking his hands from the controls, Giordino nodded out of the windshield to his left at a helicopter crossing a low ridge of mountains to the east. They must have guessed our course and overhauled us after you reduced speed to conserve fuel, Pitt surmised.
No racks mounting air-to-air rockets, observed Giordino. They'll have to shoot us down with rifles.
A burst of flame and a puff of smoke erupted from the open forward passenger door of the pursuing aircraft, and a rocket soared through the sky. Passing so close to the nose of the helicopter, Pitt and Giordino felt they could have reached out the side windows and touched it.
Correction, Pitt called. A 40-millimeter rocket launcher, the same one they used against the temple.
Giordino slammed the collective pitch into an abrupt ascent and shoved the throttles to their stops in an attempt to throw off the launcher team's aim.
Grab your rifle and keep them busy until I can reach those low clouds along the coast.
Tough luck, Pitt shouted over the shrill whine of the engines. I tossed it away and my Colt is empty. Any of you carry a gun on board?
Giordino made an imperceptible nod as he hurled the chopper in another violent maneuver.
I can't speak for the rest of them,
You'll find mine wedged in a corner behind the cabin bulkhead. Pitt took a radio headset that was hanging on the arm of his seat and clamped it over his ears. Then he struggled out of his seat and clutched both sides of the open cockpit door with his hands to stay on his feet during a sharp turn. He plugged the lead from the headset into a socket mounted on the bulkhead and hailed Giordino. "Put on your headset so we can coordinate our defense." Giordino didn't answer as he mashed down on the left pedal and skidded the craft around in a flat turn. As if he were juggling, he balanced his movements with the controls while slipping the headset over his ears. He winced and involuntarily ducked as another rocket tore through the air less than a meter under the belly of the helicopter and exploded in an orange burst of flame against the palisade of a low mountain. Grabbing whatever handhold was within reach, Pitt staggered to the side passenger door, undogged the latches, and slid the door back until it was wide open. Shannon, her face showing more concern than fear, crawled across the floor with a cargo rope and wrapped one end around Pitt's waist as he was reaching for the automatic rifle Giordino had used to knock out the Peruvian pilots. Then she tied the opposite end to a longitudinal strut. "Now you won't fall out," she exclaimed. Pitt smiled. "I don't deserve you." Then he was lying flat on his stomach, aiming the rifle out the door. "I'm ready, Al. Give me a clear shot." Giordino fought to twist the helicopter so that Pitt would face the blind side of the attackers. Because the passenger doors were positioned on the same side of both helicopters, the Peruvian pilot was faced with the same dilemma. He might have risked opening the clamshell doors in the aft end to allow the mercenary rifleman to blast away with an open line of fire, but that would have slowed his airspeed and made control of the chopper unwieldy. Like old propeller-driven warbirds tangling in a dogfight, the pilots maneuvered for an advantage, hurling their aircraft around the sky in a series of acrobatics never intended by their designers. His opponent knew his stuff, thought Giordino, with the respect of one professional for another. Outgunned by the military mercenaries, he felt like a mouse tormented by a cat before becoming a quick snack. His eyes darted from the instruments to his nemesis, then down at the ground to make certain he didn't pile into a low ridge or a tree. He yanked back the collective and broadened the pitch of the rotor blades to increase their bite in the damp air. The chopper shot upward in a maneuver matched by the other pilot. But then Giordino pushed the nose down and mashed his foot on the right rudder pedal, accelerating and throwing the craft on its side under his attacker and giving Pitt a straight shot. "Now!" he yelled in his microphone. Pitt didn't aim at the pilots in the cockpit. He sighted at the engine hump below the rotor and squeezed the trigger. The gun spat twice and went silent. "What's wrong?" inquired Giordino. "No gunfire. I run interference to the goal line, and you fumble the ball." "This gun had only two rounds in it," Pitt snapped back. "When I took it off one of Amaru's gunmen, I didn't stop to count the shells." Furious with frustration, Pitt jerked out the clip and saw it was empty. "Did any of you bring a gun on board?" he shouted to Rogers and the petrified students. Rogers, tightly strapped in a seat with legs braced against a bulkhead to avoid being bounced around by Giordino's violent tactics, spread his hands. "We left them behind when we made a break for the ship." At that instant, a rocket burst through a port window, flamed across the width of the fuselage, and exited through the opposite side of the helicopter without bursting or injuring anyone. Designed to detonate after striking armored vehicles or fortified bunkers, the rocket failed to explode after striking thin aluminum and plastic. "If one hits the turbines," Pitt thought uneasily, "it's all over." He stared wildly about the cabin, saw that they had all released their shoulder harnesses and lay huddled on the floor under the seats, as if the canvas webbing and small tubular supports could stop a 40-millimeter tank-killing rocket. He cursed as the wildly swaying aircraft threw him against the doorframe. Shannon saw the furious look on Pitt's face, the despair as he flung the empty rifle out the open door. And yet she stared at him with absolute faith in her eyes. She had come to know him well enough in the past 24 hours to know he was not a man who would willingly accept defeat. Pitt caught the look, and it infuriated him. "What do you expect me to do?" he demanded. "Leap across space and brain them with the jawbone of an ass? Or maybe they'll go away if I throw rocks at them." Pitt broke off as his eyes fell on one of the life rafts. He broke into a wild grin. "Al, you hear me?" "I'm a little busy to take calls," Giordino answered tensely. "Lay this antique on her port side and fly above them. Whatever you're concocting, make it quick before they put a rocket up our nose or we run out of fuel." "Backed by popular demand," Pitt said, becoming his old cheerful self again. "Mandrake Pitt and his death-defying magic act." He unsnapped the buckles on the tie-down straps holding one of the life rafts to the floor. The fluorescent orange raft was labeled 20-man flotation unit, in English, and weighed over 45 kilograms, 100 pounds. Leaning out the door secured by the rope Shannon had tied around his waist, both legs and feet spread and set, he hoisted the uninflated life raft onto his shoulder and waited. Giordino was tiring. Helicopters require constant hands-on concentration just to stay in the air, because they are made up of 1,000 opposing forces that want nothing to do with each other. The general rule of thumb is that most pilots fly solo for an hour. After that, they turn control over to their backup or co-pilot. Giordino had been behind the controls for an hour and a half, was denied sleep for the past 36 hours, and now the strain of throwing the aircraft all over the sky was rapidly draining what strength he had in reserve. For almost 6 minutes, an eternity in a dogfight, he had prevented his adversary from gaining a brief advantage for a clear shot from the men manning the rocket launcher. The other craft passed directly across Giordino's vulnerable glass-enclosed cockpit. For a brief instant in time, he could clearly see the Peruvian pilot. The face under the combat flight helmet flashed a set of white teeth and waved. "The bastard is laughing at me," Giordino blurted in fury. "What did you say?" came Pitt. "Those fornicating baboons think this is funny," Giordino said savagely. He knew what he had to do. He had noticed an almost indiscernible quirk to the enemy pilot's flying technique. When he bent left, there was no hesitation, but he was a fraction of a second slow in banking right. Giordino feinted left and abruptly threw the nose skyward and curled right. The other pilot caught the feint and promptly went left, but reacted too slowly to Giordino's wild ascending turn and twist in the opposite direction. Before he could counter, Giordino had hurled his machine around and over the attacker. Pitt's opportunity came in just the blink of an eye, but his timing was right on the money. Lifting the life raft above his head with both hands as easily as if it were a sofa pillow, he thrust it out the open door as the Peruvian chopper whipped beneath him. The orange bundle dropped with the impetus of a bowling ball and smashed through one of the gyrating rotor blades 2 meters, about 6 feet from the tip. The blade shattered into metallic slivers that spiraled outward from the centrifugal force. Now unbalanced, the remaining 4 blades whirled in ever-increasing vibration until they broke away from the rotor hub in a rain of small pieces. The big helicopter seemed to hang poised for a moment before it yawed in circles and angled nose-first toward the ground at 190 kilometers, 118 miles an hour. Pitt hung out the door and watched, fascinated, as the Peruvian craft bored through the trees and crashed into a low hill, only a few meters below the summit. He stared at the glinting shreds of metal that flew off into the branches of the trees. The big injured bird came to rest on its right side, a crumpled lump of twisted metal. And then it was lost in a huge fireball that erupted and wrapped it in flames and black smoke. Giordino eased back on the throttles and made a slow circular pass over the column of smoke. But neither he nor Pitt saw any evidence of life. "This has to be the first time in history an aircraft was knocked out of the sky by a life raft," said Giordino. "Improvisation. Pitt laughed softly, bowing to Shannon, Rogers, and the students, who were all applauding with rejuvenated spirits. Improvisation. Then he added, "Fine piece of flying, Al. None of us would be breathing but for you." "Ain't it the truth? Ain't it the truth?" said Giordino, turning the nose of the craft toward the west and reducing the throttle settings to conserve fuel. Pitt pulled passenger door closed, redogged the latches, untied Shannon's line from around his waist, and returned to the cockpit. "How does our fuel look?" "Fuel? What fuel?" Pitt gazed over Giordino's shoulder at the gauges. Both showed flickering red warning lights. He could also see the drawn look of fatigue on his friend's face. "Take a break and let me spell you at the controls." "I got us this far. I'll take us what little distance we have left before the tanks run dry." Pitt did not waste his breath in debate. He never ceased to marvel at Giordino's intrepid calm, his glacial fortitude. He could have searched the world and never found another friend like the tough, burly Italian. "Okay, you take her in. I'll sit this one out and pray for a tailwind." A few minutes later, they crossed over the shoreline and headed out to sea. A resort with attractive lawns and a large swimming pool encircled a small cove with a white sand beach. The sunbathing tourists looked up at the low-flying helicopter and waved. With nothing better to do, Pitt waved back. Pitt returned to the cargo cabin and approached Rogers. "We've got to dump as much weight as possible, except for survival equipment like the life vests and the remaining raft. Everything else goes. Excess clothing, tools, hardware, seats, anything that isn't welded or bolted down." Everyone pitched in and passed whatever objects they could find to Pitt, who heaved them out the passenger door. When the cabin was bare, the chopper was lighter by almost 136 kilograms, 300 pounds. Before he closed the door again, Pitt looked aft. Thankfully, he didn't see any pursuing aircraft. He was certain the Peruvian pilot had radioed the sighting and his intention to attack, blowing Pitt's Chiclayo smokescreen. But he doubted the Sope Machaco would suspect the loss of their mercenary soldiers and helicopter for at least another 10 minutes. And if they belatedly totaled the score and whistled up a Peruvian Air Force fighter jet to intercept, then it would be too late. Any attack on an unarmed American research ship would stir up serious diplomatic repercussions between the United States government and Peru, a situation the struggling South American nation could ill afford. Pitt was on safe ground in assuming that no local bureaucrat or military officer would risk political disaster, regardless of any under-the-table payoff by the Sope Machaco. Pitt limped back to the cockpit, slid into the co-pilot seat, and picked up the radio microphone. He brushed aside all caution as he pressed the transmit button. To hell with any bought-and-paid-for Sope Machaco cronies who were monitoring the airwaves, he thought. "Numa calling Deep Fathom. Talk to me, Stucky." "Come in, Numa. This is Deep Fathom. What is your position?" "My, what big eyes you have, and how your voice has changed, Grandma." "Say again, Numa." "Not even a credible effort," Pitt laughed. "Rich Little, you ain't." He looked over at Giordino. "We've got a comic impersonator on our party line." "I think you better give him our position," Giordino said, with more than a trace of cynicism in his voice. "Right you are," Pitt nodded. "Deep Fathom, this is Numa. Our position is just south of the Magic Castle between Jungle Land and the Pirates of the Caribbean." "Please repeat your position," came the voice of the flustered mercenary who had broken in on Pitt's call to Stucky. "What's this, a radio commercial for Disneyland?" Stucky's familiar voice popped over the speaker. "Well, well, the genuine article. What took you so long to answer, Stucky?" "I was listening to what my alter ego had to say. You guys landed in Chiclayo yet?" "We were sidetracked and decided to head home," said Pitt. "Is the skipper handy?" "He's on the bridge playing Captain Bly, lashing the crew in an attempt to set a speed record. Another knot and our rivets will start falling out." "We do not have a visual on you. Do you have us on radar?" "Affirmative. answered Stuckey. Change your heading to 272 magnetic. That will put us on a converging course.
Altering course to 272, Giordino acknowledged. How far to rendezvous? Pitt asked Stuckey.
The skipper makes it about 60 kilometers.
They should be in sight soon. Pitt looked over at Giordino. What do you think?
Giordino stared woefully at the fuel gauges, then at the instrument panel clock. The dial read 10:47 a.m. He couldn't believe so much had happened in so little time, since he and Pitt had responded to the rescue appeal by the impostor of Doc Miller. He swore it took 3 years off his life expectancy.
I'm milking her for every liter of fuel at an airspeed of only 40 clicks an hour, he said finally. A slight tailwind off the shore helps, but I estimate we have only another 15 or 20 minutes of flight time left. Your guess is as good as mine.
Let us hope the gauges read on the low side, said Pitt.
Hello, Stuckey.
I'm here.
You'd better prepare for a water rescue. All predictions point to a wet landing.
I'll pass the word to the skipper. Alert me when you ditch.
You'll be the first to know.
Good luck.
The helicopter droned over the tops of the rolling swells. Pitt and Giordino spoke very little. Their ears were tuned to the sound of the turbines, as if expecting them to abruptly go silent at any moment. They instinctively tensed when the fuel warning alarm whooped through the cockpit.
So much for the reserves, said Pitt. Now we're flying on fumes.
He looked down at the deep cobalt blue of the water only 10 meters, 33 feet, beneath the belly of the chopper. The sea looked reasonably smooth. He figured wave height from trough to crest was less than a meter. The water looked warm and inviting. A power-off landing did not appear to be too rough, and the old MI-8 should float for a good 60 seconds if Giordino didn't burst the seams when he dropped her in. Pitt called Shannon to the cockpit. She appeared in the doorway, looked down at him, and smiled faintly.
Is your ship in sight?
Just over the horizon, I should think, but not close enough to reach with the fuel that's left. Tell everybody to prepare for a water landing.
Then we do have to swim the rest of the way, she said cynically.
A mere technicality, said Pitt.
Have Rogers move the life raft close to the passenger door and be ready to heave it in the water as soon as we ditch, and impress upon him the importance of pulling the inflation cord after the raft is safely through the door. I, for one, do not want to get my feet wet.
Giordino pointed dead ahead.
The deep fathom.
Pitt nodded as he squinted at the dark, tiny speck on the horizon. He spoke into the radio mic.
We have you on visual, Stuckey.
Come to the party, answered Stuckey. We'll open the bar early just for you.
Heaven forbid, said Pitt, elaborately sarcastic. I don't imagine the Admiral will take kindly to that suggestion.
Their employer, Chief Director of the National Underwater and Marine Agency, Admiral James Sandecker, had a regulation etched in stone banning all alcoholic spirits from Numa vessels. A vegetarian and a fitness nut, Sandecker thought he was adding years to the hired help's lifespan. As with prohibition in the 1920s, men who seldom touched the stuff began smuggling cases of beer on board or buying it in foreign ports.
Would you prefer a hearty glass of Ovaltine? Retorted Stuckey.
Only if you mix it with carrot juice and alfalfa sprouts.
We just lost an engine, announced Giordino conversationally. Pitt's eyes darted to the instruments. Across the board, the needles of the gauges monitoring the port turbine were flickering back to their stops. He turned and looked up at Shannon.
Warn everyone that we'll impact the water on the starboard side of the aircraft.
Shannon looked confused.
Why not land vertically?
If we go in bottom first, the rotor blades settle, strike the water, and shatter on a level with the fuselage. The whirling fragments can easily penetrate the cabin's skin, especially the cockpit, resulting in the loss of our intrepid pilot's head. Coming down on the side throws the shattered blades out and away from us.
Why the starboard side? "I don't have a chalk and a blackboard," snapped Pitt in exasperation. "So you'll die happy. It has to do with the directional rotation of the rotor blades and the fact the exit door is on the port side." Enlightened, Shannon nodded.
"Understood."
"Immediately after impact," Pitt continued, "get the students out the door before this thing sinks. Now get to your seat and buckle up." Then he slapped Giordino on the shoulder. "Take her in while you still have power," he said as he snapped on his safety harness. Giordino needed no coaxing. Before he lost his remaining engine, he pulled back on the collective pitch and pulled back the throttle on his one operating engine. As the helicopter lost its forward motion from a height of 3 meters above the sea, he leaned it gently onto the starboard side. The rotor blades smacked the water and snapped off in a cloud of debris and spray as the craft settled in the restless waves with the awkward poise of a pregnant albatross. The impact came with the jolt of a speeding car hitting a sharp dip in the road. Giordino shut down the one engine and was pleasantly surprised to find the old MI-8, Hip C, floating drunkenly in the sea as if she belonged there. "End of the line," Pitt boomed. "Everyone the hell out." The gentle lapping of the waves against the fuselage came as a pleasant contrast to the fading whine of the engines and thump of the rotor blades. The pungent salt air filled the stuffy interior of the compartment when Roger slid open the passenger door and dropped the collapsible 20-person life raft into the water. He was extra careful not to pull the inflation cord too soon and was relieved to hear the hiss of compressed air and see the raft puff out safely beyond the door. In a few moments it was bobbing alongside the helicopter, its mooring line tightly clutched in Roger's hand. "Out you go," Rogers yelled, herding the young Peruvian archaeology students through the door and into the raft. Pitt released his safety harness and hurried into the rear cabin. Shannon and Rogers had the evacuation running smoothly. All but three of the students had climbed into the raft. A quick examination of the aircraft made it clear she couldn't stay afloat for long. The clamshell doors were buckled from the impact just enough to allow water to surge in around the seams. Already the floor of the fuselage was beginning to slant toward the rear, and the waves were sloshing over the sill of the open passenger door. "We haven't much time," he said, helping Shannon into the raft. Rogers went next, and then he turned to Giordino. "Your turn, Al." Giordino would have none of it. Tradition of the sea, all walking wounded go first. Before Pitt could protest, Giordino shoved him out the door, and then followed as the water swept over his ankles. Breaking out the raft's paddles, they pushed clear of the helicopter as its long tail boom dipped into the waves. Then a large swell surged through the opening passenger door, and the helicopter slipped backward into the uncaring sea. She disappeared with a faint gurgle and a few ripples, her shattered rotor blades being the last to go, the stumps slowly rotating from the force of the current, as if she were descending to the seafloor under her own power. The water surged through her open door, and she plunged under the waves to a final landing on the seafloor. No one spoke. They all seemed saddened to see the helicopter go. It was as if they all suffered a personal loss. Pitt and Giordino were at home on the water. The others, suddenly finding themselves floating on a vast sea, felt an awful sense of emptiness coupled with the dread of helplessness. The latter feeling was particularly enhanced when a shark's fin abruptly broke the water and ominously began circling the raft. "All your fault," Giordino said to Pitt in mock exasperation. "He's homed in on the scent of blood from your leg wound." Pitt peered into the transparent water, studying the sleek shape as it passed under the raft. Recognizing the horizontal stabilizer-like head with the eyes mounted like aircraft wing lights on the tips. A hammerhead. No more than 2.5 meters long. I shall ignore him. Shannon gave a shudder and moved closer to Pitt and clutched his arm.
What if he decides to take a bite out of the raft and we sink?
Pitt shrugged. Sharks seldom find life rafts appetizing. "He invited his pals for dinner," said Giordino, pointing to two more fins cutting the water. Pitt could see the beginnings of panic on the faces of the young students. He nestled into a comfortable position on the bottom of the raft elevated his feet on the upper float, and closed his eyes. "Nothing like a restful nap under a warm sun on a calm sea. Wake me when the ship arrives." Shannon stared at him in disbelief.
"He must be mad."
Giordino quickly sized up Pitt's scheme and settled in.
"That makes two of us."
No one knew quite how to react. Every pair of eyes in the raft swiveled from the seemingly dozing men from Numa to the circling sharks and back again. The panic slowly subsided to uneasy apprehension while the minutes crawled by as if they were each an hour long. Other sharks joined the pre-dinner party, but all hearts began filling with newfound hope as the deep fathom hove into view, her bows carving the water in a spray of foam. No one on board knew the old workhorse of Numa's oceanographic fleet could drive so hard. Down in the engine room, the chief engineer, August Burley, a powerfully built man with a portly stomach, walked the catwalk between the ship's big diesels, closely observing the needles on the RPM gauges, which were hard in the red, and listening for any signs of metal fatigue from the overstressed engines. On the bridge, Captain Frank Stewart gazed through binoculars at the tiny splash of orange against the blue sea. "We'll come right up on them at half speed before reversing the engines," he said to the helmsman. "You don't want to stop and drift up to them, Captain?" asked the blond, ponytailed man at the wheel. "They're surrounded by a school of sharks," said Stewart. "We can't waste time with caution." He stepped over and spoke into the ship's speaker system. "We'll approach the survivors on the port side. All available hands prepare to bring them aboard." It was a neat bit of seamanship. Stewart stopped the ship within 2 meters of the life raft with only a slight wash. Several crewmen stared down and waved, leaning far over the railing and bulwark to shout greetings. The boarding ladder had been lowered, and a crewman stood on the lower platform with a boat hook. He extended it, the end was grabbed by Giordino, and the raft was pulled in alongside the platform. The sharks were forgotten, and everyone began smiling and laughing with unabashed happiness at having survived death without major injuries at least 4 times since being taken hostage. Shannon stared up at the towering hull of the research ship, took in the ungainly superstructure and derricks, and turned to Pitt with a shrewd twinkle in her eyes.
"You promised us a 4-star hotel and a refreshing bath. Certainly not a rusty old workboat."
Pitt laughed. "A rose by any other name. Any port in a storm. So you share my attractive but homespun stateroom. As a gentleman, I'll give you the lower berth while I suffer the indignities of the upper." Shannon looked at him with amusement.
"Taking a lot for granted, aren't you?"
As Pitt relaxed and kept a paternal eye on the occupants of the raft, who were climbing the ladder one after the other, he smiled fiendishly at Shannon and murmured, "Okay, we'll keep a low profile. You can have the upper, and I'll take the lower."